Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. Hello and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here. This is episode number 126. It is after Labor Day. Beautiful time of year for the stock market to be roaring, rip-roaring that is. Not much news. We saw oil kind of spike up and do some interesting things. And we're going to have some discussion today about China. We're going to have discussion about maybe the banks. And we'll have some discussion today with some good friends of mine. First up, we're going to have Vitaly Katsin-Nelson, who is very much involved in understanding of China and the inner workings of that. So I'm going to ask him some questions about that. And then we're going to have John Markman, a friend of ours, a good friend of mine, MSN Money writer, as well as Strategic Advantage newsletter. Really all around, very smart fellow. Something you want to pay attention to when he talks. I do. I speak to him often, and I think his words are words of wisdom. The other thing I want to mention to you is if you want to follow me on Twitter, of course, you can do so, Andrew Horowitz. Just go to Andrew Horowitz and sign up to follow me on Twitter. You'll get the first release of when the podcast comes out immediately because every post that we put on automatically bounces over to Twitter at the second that it's actually released. So this way, if you're waiting for information, wondering when it comes out, whether you can do it, of course, through iTunes or something like that. But, you know, you can get some alerts of what's happening, as well as the information that we put out throughout the week. So if you're ever wondering, like, how do I find out if he's talking about this stock or this ETF or what's happening in the economy? Well, Twitter will have it for you. So go sign up for that at Andrew Horowitz over at Twitter. Okay? The other thing I thought we'd to start with, because we're probably going to have, I'm going to have two different people on today, so it's probably going to be a longer session. I thought we'd talk a little bit about what's going on with the healthcare issue. If you saw last week, President Obama talked a little bit, so to speak, spoke a lot about what to expect, although a little bit about the details. Matter of fact, during the speech, he even talked about how, you know, the things that he's talking about were great, but, you know, we have to iron out some of the details, I think was his quote, and it, you know, got a nice big laugh in the audience that night. But at the same time, we wonder, you know, what is really going to unfold from this? Are the HMOs going to be in trouble? They're going to be, seeing some real, you know, problems and taking down their profits? Well, if the markets have any indicator of that, well, the answer is no. The HMOs have done very nicely of late. On the other hand, are we going to see some problems with competition with a public plan? They said that the public plan that's going to be had right now would be just, for people that can't get insurance, they can't afford it. It's going to be a separate component, not available for everyone, it seems, and it's going to be a competition, sort of a marketplace that will be involved with this healthcare public option. So it seems that the people who are looking for that public option may have gotten it in a shrunken down version. It also looks like we're not having what's called universal healthcare or socialized healthcare at this point. And the question still remains, how are they going to actually pay for that? One of the things that President Obama mentioned was that they're going to shave a lot of costs off of the excess waste and spending and fraud and all the problems with Medicare and Medicaid. The question I ask is, being as inquisitive as I am, how come we haven't done so yet? How come that hasn't been a priority yet to really take down all the fraud and the excess spending and the problems, the fat, if you will, within the Medicare and Medicaid area? Because if I think it would be a really good way to show us that, you know what, you're not going to add to the budget deficit. You're not going to, you know, bring us higher than the $9 trillion that's already been discussed. That will be in by 2019, I think it is, they expect the budget deficit to be about $9 trillion from about $1.5 trillion where it is right now. I think where we entered this year, it was $1 trillion. So we're already moving up pretty high. And it's expected to move much more rapidly and start steamrolling much more rapidly. And that's what happens with credit. You know, if you ever had a credit and you max out one credit card and then you go to another credit card and then you go to another credit card, all of a sudden you have these minimum payments that you have to make, but they add up very quickly. So, you know, that's kind of what's happening with our budget deficit right now. They're not really spending wisely. The question is, can they actually do so? I don't know. I've seen no sense of urgency by Congress to stop spending. I mean, the amount of money that they're spending right now between the banks, the stimulus, between propping up the economy, now this healthcare initiative, and on and on and on, does not seem to be restraint in any measure. So we really have to question what's happening there. In terms of the markets, in terms of what's happening, we've been finding some great opportunities. When you look at things on the technical basis in particular, you know, blending the fundamental and technical, that I think that have been interesting because they're following a bit of a pattern right now. Kind of the bouncing off the 50-day, bouncing off the 20-day, maintaining support. We saw a lot of stocks do that recently. Last week, the week before last, was kind of a tough week for the markets. And then we saw this magical turnaround when we saw that, I guess people are a little bit numb to the employment numbers right now. And so I think the markets right now have a general trajectory and has a mind of its own towards that 1060 number that we looked at on the Fibonacci retracement levels. And once we see that number, I question where we're going to go from there. Could we keep on going because of the excess stimulus? It's possible. We'll talk to some of our guests about that in a second when we get back. And in the meantime, if you have any questions, you know where to find me. Just ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And also, don't forget, if you want to see that 14-minute virtual tour, just head on over to the show notes. We put a new link on the website. People said they couldn't find it, where it says show notes, right on the top of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And what you can do is just click on that, and it will bring up the show notes from this show, this podcast, all things that we talked about, the bios of who we talked to, maybe if they have a book or if they have a free subscription or something like that. So when we get back, we're going to get right into it with my friend Vitaly, and then we're going to talk with John Markman. Stick around. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be right back. Okay, and we're back here with Vitaly Katsenelson. He is a friend of mine. He works with Investment Management Associates, and I've been reading his work for a while, and I think you're going to be really interested because we're going to talk about things like gold today, some things that a lot of you are very interested in, some of the precious metals, some of the concern about, hey, if we're going into an inflationary market, is gold a place to be? Is it a place that we want to invest? So, Vitaly, how are you, my friend?
Well, I'm doing great. Thank you.
So, let's talk a little bit about gold, because I think that people are going to have a real interest in this, because a lot of people have been talking about how gold is the inflation protector. Now, let me just tell you my quickie on this, okay? Mm-hmm. My theory is that gold could be a good investment in certain times, okay? Fine. But you know what? If we're using it for the availability of inflation protection or the bunker mentality, when everything goes to hell in a handbasket, I would much rather have a can of tuna fish. I figure you got food out of it, you got oil that could be for heating, you got maybe a tool equipment out of it. So what's your opinion on gold?
Well, I think I agree with you, but I also would own guns at the same time. So tuna fish and guns.
Okay.
No, actually, it's kind of interesting. If you think about gold, It is kind of like a religion in a sense. If you talk to gold bugs about it, and if you say anything negative about it, it's like you're insulting their god.
Right.
My take on gold is this: that you watch TV and you see a lot of those commercials that basically proclaim gold to be kind of almost like a riskless investment, that where it can only the government is printing currency, et cetera, et cetera. The world is coming to an end, and the gold can only go up. And the way I look at gold, maybe it should have a small place in your portfolio, but a small place. Okay.
What does that mean? Is that 1%,
5%? I don't know. Maybe 5%.
Okay.
But it's my concern is that a lot of people actually take those commercials seriously, and they put in the whole net worth, in gold, and that's what worries me. So what I did, I came up with this kind of with some reasons why. Why gold may not do as well as people think it will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, number one, nobody knows what gold is worth. Gold is not a kind of a cash flow producing asset, and therefore you can't really value it. I mean, you and I can argue for hours about Microsoft, you know, what it's worth, but we probably agree it's worth between somewhere $20 and $40, right?
Okay.
Yeah, maybe $15 or $20, $40, mm-hmm. but there was at least it produces cash flow, it has cash on the balance sheet, you know. We may have different assumptions about the growth rate, but we all agreed, you know, on the bulk of value. The problem with gold, it's only worth something if people think it's worth something, because it has very little utility, you know.
Right.
So the another reason I would be concerned about owning gold is that you would the seventh largest holder of gold is a gold ETF, the GLD.
Correct. Right.
So just think about it, seventh largest holder in the world. It's actually it's ahead of China, ahead of Switzerland, it's ahead of many other countries. And the problem is that ETF actually holds physical gold.
Right.
So whenever people buy it, it's it has to go up and it has to go and buy gold.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my question: what if we have some hedge fund liquidations?
Right.
And they have to sell gold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a gold ETF. Then, you know, there is not enough natural buyers, you know, for that much gold, and therefore it just, you know, could destroy prices overnight. The third reason, which is probably the most important one, in the past, gold had a monopoly, kind of on the fear trade. You know, if you were concerned about, you know, what's going on right now, basically like high inflation, you know, the world coming to an end, etc., you would buy gold. You had no other options.
Right.
Okay, today, if you're concerned about interest rate going up or inflation going up, you can buy TIPS, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
And TIPS are not perfect investment, and I understand this, but it's an alternative that wasn't there, you know, 20 years ago. You can buy an ETF that shorts treasury bonds. You can buy an ETF that shorts a dollar. You know,
right.
There's so many alternatives. So my point is, gold used to have a monopoly on this kind of fear trade and inflation trade and, you know, world coming to an end trade. And that monopoly is not there anymore.
Right.
So we don't really know how it's going to perform.
Well, then, you know, we had Dennis Gartman on not too long ago, and one of the things that he likes, if you follow Dennis, is, you know, he likes stuff that can actually, it's kind of like the George Carlin of finance, without the foul language, I guess. But, you know, he likes stuff that when if it falls on your foot, it will hurt. So you're talking about, you know, some materials, and he was a big fan of copper, not so much of gold, I don't think, but, you know, of things that have, you know, tangible assets. So are there other tangible assets that may be an alternative? Because a lot of people want to actually touch and hold something, because while we understand that Microsoft is valued at something, whether it's a cash flow basis, a discounted cash flow basis, whether it's because of their, just let's say their book value, let's just say their cash on hand, or whatever else it may be, it's still a piece of paper you have at the end of the day. So a lot of people like to have that comfort. Now, obviously, an ETF is a piece of paper as well. It's not really saying that you own this much gold. But what about silver? What about platinum? What about any of those other precious materials and diamonds, things like that, or oil, or maybe agricultural? What about those kind of things?
Well, I think I was going to say the same thing. You know, if you own an oil ETF, it doesn't fall in your foot, right? Because it is a piece of, you know, paper,
right,
or electronic,
right,
bits stored in a computer. Here is my issue with them. If you look at let's look at oil, for instance. If you look over the last 5 years, the 3/4 of incremental demand for oil came from China.
Mm-hmm.
And, Chinese economy was growing at extremely high rates. And I think a lot, you know, and I have a suspicion that the growth going forward is going to be horrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be, I'm not sure if, you know, I'm not predicting, you know, the end of Chinese economy, but I think that, you know, it's going to be a lot less going forward than it was in the past for many reasons. I mean, first of all, when the economy of that size is growing at rates that it has grown in the past, a lot of the growth is kind of has a low quality.
Mm-hmm.
I actually wrote an article last year comparing Chinese economy to Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this, it's not the analogy that,
right,
that clicks right away, but but actually it makes sense.
All right, we'll hear it.
Okay. So think about it this way. Starbucks was growing, and I'm going to make up the number right now because I don't remember, but it was growing, let's say, 15-20% a year for 20 years. Okay. At the time it was growing 15-20% a year, at first it was opening 100 stores, 200 stores, 300 stores. Okay. But then at some point it got so big that for Starbucks to grow, you know, as fast as it did, at the same percentage rate, it has to open 1,000 stores.
Right.
Suddenly, it has to still open 3 or 4 stores a day,
mm-hmm.
right? And what happens when you become so big and you open that many stores, and you're looking for to grow, you basically start opening stores that compete with each other. You're still going to start compromising on your hiring decisions.
Well, this is what happened. This is what happened with Dell. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, when you had that everybody's like, wow, Dell's growing at, let's just say, 50% per year. But then when you extrapolated it out, the fact was that means that everybody had to have 3 computers on their desktop for Dell for next year to have the same growth rate.
Exactly. And you're right. But another problem with that is that the quality of the growth in the late stages becomes horrible. And when the Starbucks realized how horrible the growth was, they ended up closing hundreds of stores, right? And in China, we see the same thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you this example. The largest shopping mall in the world is in China.
Mm-hmm.
It was built to have, I think, 1,600 stores, and it only has 13 stores open. It's basically a huge parking lot.
Hmm.
It's a lot of concrete that's been wasted, and billions of dollars.
And why is that? Wasted. Why is that?
Why? Because China, it's a People's Republic of China, but it's not really people's, and it's not really a republic. It's really, we think of China, we think of it as a kind of a capitalist economy, but it's not. It's a communist economy, and therefore the capital allocation decisions are done by a couple hundred people at the very top, or maybe a couple thousand people at the very top.
No, it sounds like here.
Well, trust me, it's not. I mean, and the reason I can judge it, I was born in Russia and moved here about 18 years ago.
Right.
And and Russia in many ways was like China, so I know how inefficient capital allocations are when it's done by political connections. There was a very interesting video on YouTube of a hedge fund manager walking in the downtown of one of the biggest, one of the big Chinese cities, and he's showing you skyscrapers that rival the Empire State Building that are fully empty. Okay, it's almost like reminding me of Miami a little bit. Those apartments, empty apartments.
It's my backyard.
Exactly. So it's kind of like the same thing. In fact, China reminds me of Miami a little bit, because you have a growth at any cost. You have a lot of money thrown at it, and
but the difference is you can't get a good chicken with black bean sauce down here.
No, you're probably right.
Yeah. Let me ask you something. I've read your articles about China because you've really been quite most recently on the negative on China. And what's interesting about that is, just for everybody to know and to give you some kudos on this, that article came out when you talked about the concern about a fall in the China markets, particularly in Shanghai. I think not the you weren't really talking about Hong Kong as much, but that's before right in the beginning of the downfall of, I think it was a 21% decline in the Shanghai index over August.
Well, it was probably the comparison of to Starbucks, late stage growth obesity, where I compare Starbucks to China, actually came out on the first day of Olympics last year.
Okay.
It's almost a year ago. So when everybody was in love with China, and my point was at the time that the quality of the growth is not good. And then I wrote more articles when the global economy was slowing down and was going into recession, in China, Chinese economy, it seems like defied the laws of gravity or economics, and it kept growing. And then we learned that its electricity consumption was declining,
right?
4 or 5%. And also, but also then we found out that its definition of GDP numbers are very different than ours.
Well, what's interesting is, Vitaly, about that, one of the things that I find really interesting of late is that, and I've talked about this before, is the amount of information that's coming out of China like never before.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's because of the internet, the connectivity, the worldwide nature of this global economic crisis, or whatever. I don't know what it is.
Sure.
But it seems like almost once a week we're getting updates of GDP from China.
That's right. But you have to be extremely careful. I mean, number one, it's a good thing that you have more information. But more information does not mean that the quality of information is good.
Right.
And let me give you this couple of numbers that if you read the headline number that GDP is growing, you say 8%, where it used to grow 10%, you say, oh, this is great, Chinese economy is growing. But then you read other numbers that are few people pay attention to, like electricity consumption, is declining. How could the electricity consumption decline in the economy that's producing stuff, right? I mean, it's not like it's producing intellectual capital and it became just, you know, suddenly...
Let me throw this out. Could it be cooler weather? Could it be that they're using more efficient things like solar and wind power? I'm just asking. I don't know.
No, I mean... First of all, those things usually take time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, we're talking about it used to be growing 6% and it started to decline 4%. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's historically GDP, it happened to kind of coincide with the global recession. And also, if you remember that China is a big exporter to the United States and to the rest of the world, and we start to import less. So the point is, the GDP numbers were fraudulent, basically. I mean, they were not fraudulent. We recently discovered how they compute their GDP numbers, and it's actually kind of funny. The moment they decide to allocate capital to a project, that goes into GDP growth number.
Wow.
So if you were to compute this number, the numbers ourselves like this, they would be growing 20% a year, not declining.
Right. So essentially, what they can do is they can book the profit. This would be the equivalent of a company booking the profit. When they agreed that they were going to do it, not doing it as the money was received in.
Exactly. No. Exactly. And another interesting number was the one of the railroads reported their numbers, and the tonnage shipped in the first 6 months of the year declined 23% to 25%. So that's another number that. So you're right. It's a good thing that you see more numbers from China, but you really have to. You'd be very careful.
But here's the thing. We're seeing, for example, I'll give you some numbers in Japan. In Japan, we're seeing that exports have fallen by, 45 or 50%. And each of the numbers that are coming out most recently have been, confirmations that year over year are still down dramatically. Now, some of the comparisons will start to get a lot better very soon. Mm-hmm. Because, we're going to compare 1 year ago versus 1 year ago. And when we see that when they dropped off the cliff at the end of the year, that's all of a sudden going to look better no matter what happens, essentially, okay?
Sure.
But what is it that, deflation is supposed to be bad. We have deflation all over the place, or at least definitely not inflation at this point right now from the numbers I'm talking about. And we have limited exports. We have unemployment at a high rate. I'm talking about Japan and Asia, some areas, Japan in particular now. But the markets seem to be going to new highs. What's the story with that?
The good news is that I think the rationale for that is that, first of all, I think the Great Depression, too, is off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the initial shock that sent the market up.
Mm-hmm.
And things are getting less bad. I mean, and so that's good news, except that... I'm a stock picker, basically, and you are as well,
mm-hmm.
I suppose. And so you and I look at individual companies. And when you look at the individual company, you basically have to make some certain assumptions. What is the earnings power of this company?
Mm-hmm.
And let me give you an example, which is kind of American Express. I like American Express as a financial stock because it's one of the few financial stocks you can analyze.
Right.
Because it's very transparent, it's clear, right?
Mm-hmm.
You look at American Express, and they're, and they basically have two businesses. They have discount fee business, which is basically their network business, and they have the credit card business.
Mm-hmm.
So if you basically make some assumptions about the credit card business, and here are the assumptions I made. In 2007, the net write-offs in the credit card business were 3.3%,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, it's all-time low for them.
Yeah.
Okay. And that number was basically influenced by two kind of broad factors. We had a bankruptcy law in 2005 that forced a lot of people to
file. Right. That was huge. That was when you saw that a lot of people look at that and look at, oh my gosh, look at all the bankruptcies in 2005. That was people getting in because there was a law change right before the law changed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that lowered their, the bankruptcies that followed, '06 or 2007. So
right.
It
kind of like was cash for clunkers. It pushed everything forward. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. It's like, yes. And the second reason, was that, the economy was expanding, you could borrow money at home equity loan at 3%, to pay off your credit cards, etc. So you and I can agree that number, 3.3%, was an artificially low number.
Right.
So you're not going to see it for a very long time.
Yeah.
Today, those write-offs are about close to 10%. So they tripled. So, and, you know, with those write-offs, American Express is expected to make about $1 a share, this year.
Mm-hmm.
So if it trades about 10 times earnings today based on the 07 number, or it trades about 34 times earnings based on the 09 number, right? And neither number is right. We know that 10% write-offs will not continue forever, right? As well as, 3.3% write-offs we're not going to last.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of normalized the write-offs at 4.5%, 5.5%. And suddenly their earnings power declines actually goes up from today's level from $1 to about $2.20.
Okay, what's the multiple now then?
So that's about 15 times, 15, 16 times.
Which is not the worst thing, but it's still a little high for that kind of company.
Well, yes, and basically, even if you say it's fair, right, I'm basically saying, all right, American Express is going to have write-offs about 4.5%, 5.5%, and that's what is pricing into the stock today, even though those write-offs are not there yet. So it's almost like it's already fairly priced for the future, average future scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's the point I'm trying to make. The earnings power of American Express, if you bought American Express thinking it can make $3.26 a share, that number has been impaired. Has it been permanently impaired? May not be, but may take 5 years or longer for the American Express to see that number again.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? So therefore, you have to kind of sub-normalize or normalize earnings for companies. And once you do that, you realize this market is not cheap. And a lot of investors...
It's not cheap. Let's talk about that for a second. It's not cheap from now through the next year, let's say, as an example. Next 2 years, maybe. Not cheap. It could be properly valued in 2 years from now, as an example. I'm just saying, because if you normalize, is what I'm saying.
Well, that's the thing. The best case, it's fairly valued if you normalize it.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's not cheap, but it's at least in the best case, it's fairly valued. And I want to emphasize the word the best case.
Mm-hmm.
My beef, the reason I spend so much time talking about China is this, because you and I were talking about the stocks, the stuff stocks, the oil, the mm-hmm. materials, industrial stocks,
right.
etc. Those companies, their earnings have been impaired significantly for a lot longer than 2 years.
Right.
Because for a couple of reasons. Number one, the 2007 earnings numbers were
extraordinary.
Right, yes. Yeah. They're not going to see them for maybe for a decade.
Right.
Okay. And the problem is also, if you look at I like to pick on Caterpillar because everybody can relate to it. Caterpillar is kind of a typical industrial stock, right?
Mm-hmm.
It makes big machines like a house.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Once you have one of those, you don't need another one for a long time.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the things that we did was we bought a company called Ritchie Brothers. Ritchie Brothers is an auctioneer, and they auctioneer primarily Caterpillars and Deers and Komatsus and all those big old things that all those guys like to get in and drive. And there's a lot of them, by the way. A lot of cranes, a lot of backhoes, a lot of bulldozers, a lot of this stuff, because a lot of people went out of business. Now, my secondary point about Caterpillar is, and I wonder about this, is that who's buying new Caterpillars? I mean, if you have the option and you have a deal, and it's probably a cut-down deal to begin with, right, in these environments... not the richest of deals that were out there, you're not going to either rent one, you'll buy one maybe that was used, or use one that you already had, because there's a lot of capacity in that area. So I don't even understand what happened with Caterpillar and how that stock went up 30% or so after they came out with the most ugliest earnings I've ever seen.
That you are so right. I would have hugged you, but I'd be on the phone. You're absolutely right. Caterpillar is one of the cases, the reason I compare it to a house, because the second you sell a house, it starts competing with your future house in sales,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Same thing with Caterpillar, and I think the idea, I don't know much about the company, but I think conceptually the idea, I like it a lot, because the demand for the demand for used equipment is going to be a lot greater for new, than
right.
for new equipment.
Right.
And the good thing is, there's a lot of used equipment out there.
Uh-huh.
And unlike a house, if you build too many houses in California, you can't really move those houses to to Colorado, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can move those, those Caterpillars from California to Colorado. So there is a lot more liquidity, Yeah,
well, one of the big things they said, that they're making inroads in China, but we also know that there's a bit of protectionism going on. And why would China use Caterpillars? And I don't know, there's another discussion with Navistar and Caterpillar doing something in China. I mean, you know, all we have to do is mention China. Everybody gets all, you know, hot and bothered and wants to buy the stock.
That's right. And you know, also, we realize if, there is a lot of overcapacity in China. If, you know, in a sense, the economy was geared for 10% growth rate, okay? And if here's my example. You see, if you open a new factory, and you're thinking, okay, we'll be growing 10%, so I'm going to build a factory for next, you know, for at least to accommodate demand for the next 5 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be 50% larger, you know, than the previous one or something. And so, but what if demand is not 10%, not increase 10% a year, but only 5% a year? It means you have 25% of extra capacity,
right?
And multiply this by hundreds and hundreds. So I think there is a lot of overcapacity in China. So therefore, demand for stuff is going to be even lower than you think, you know, than you would normally think. Hmm. Just for that reason.
Well, I mean, they seem to be stockpiling a lot, and whether they're doing it because they want to, and making a lot of, you know, crowing noises about the dollar and maybe some alternative currencies, etc. Let me ask you something. What's your, you know, a lot of people get confused about the differential between China and Hong Kong, right? I mean, there's a differential there, and there's different ways to invest there. What is your best way of describing the differences, and whether you like one or the other?
You know what? I really, to be honest, this is kind of outside of my core expertise. Though the only comment that comes to mind, they're probably interlinked, and if China goes, and I could be wrong about it, but this is just the first thing that comes to mind, it will impact Hong Kong. I mean, that's all I know.
Yeah, it seems to me that Hong Kong's more like New York City, where China is more like, you know, the plains.
It's possible. You know, really, this is outside, you know.
I hear you. So let me talk about one last thing with you. You know,
sure.
the BRIC countries, the BRIC,
sure,
which is,
sure,
Brazil, Russia, India, and China.
Sure.
We have an affinity for that area, although without the R. Sorry, buddy.
Don't blame you.
Russia, one of the things that we have is this weird kind of concept that any market that will close at any given time due to, you know, inability to keep up with demand of selling and all that is, all, you know, could be a problem for us. And is Russia on the way back, or is this just so oil dependent and so commodity dependent that they're going to be mired in just a mess because of all the oligarchs and all the issues there? Or what do you think?
You know, there's an expression, one-trick pony. I call Russia one-trick petrochemical pony.
Mm.
Because, you know, Russian economy, unfortunately, has been hurt. I mean, well, let me put it this way. Russian economy, for the most part, is an export-based petrochemical economy. You know, it exports oil and natural gas and maybe some other commodities. But, unfortunately, you know, the exports of commodities have crippled many other industries, like, you know, that it could have developed, because the return on capital in commodity industries were so much higher than, like, let's say, in the software industry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and therefore, kind of naturally, the capital flew. You know, capital has flown to the highest return on capital industry, and therefore, other industries haven't developed, you know, over the last 10 years, for the most part. I'm generalizing. So, and Russia, it's kind of going back to some degree in my mind, because it's, when I left Russia in 1991, it was going towards a democracy, and from late 90s to today, it's kind of been going back towards the kind of dictatorship to some degree. And also, when I think of, you know, what Russia did in 2004, I mean, I think 2005, 2006, the way they dealt with foreign oil companies, I think that hurt them a lot,
yeah,
their credibility in the world. Because,
right,
you know, the quick story is this. In 1990s, when the oil prices were very low, Russia needed the foreign capital.
Mm-hmm.
So the, you know, BP Amoco and Royal Dutch Shell at the time came to Russia, invested billions of dollars, and they had a fairly lucrative contract. But you have to remember, at the time, Russia needed the capital and oil prices were very low. And so then oil prices skyrocketed, and Russia sees that those companies are making a lot of money. And Russia wants some of that. And basically what Russia did, it forced those companies to sell those projects to Gazprom at the unfavorable prices. And, you know, and the reason, the way it forced it is basically said, either you sell it or we're going to shut you down, you know, because you're polluting our environment. And that's, you know, and basically they figured out that, you know, they're going to lose either way, so they, you know, they're going to lose, you know, losing less.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were forced to sell. So now, if, you know, Russia, now foreign capital is, does not really want to flow to Russia anymore because, you know, they are, they, you know, because it's a less risky country now. So I think, you know, Russia hurt its credibility in the world market by doing that.
Yeah, I hear you.
So I'm not a big buyer. I'm not a big investor in Russia.
Yeah. Well, it's a lovely country. I've been there myself. Listen, Vitaly Katsenelson, and also I'd like to recommend everybody. We'll put links to your blog. We'll also put links to your book, Active Investing. I think that's something that people should read. I would like to say that you are a wonderful writer. A great way of educating and explaining things in your writing. And I encourage people to check out your blog and you know, sign up for your emails and all that. And I appreciate you joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, have a good day, buddy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And with me today, I promised you, John Markman, one of the guys that I go to get expert advice because he is always on the money, in my opinion. Writes for MSN Money. He also has a great newsletter that I encourage you to get. He also has a couple of books out and one coming. John Markman, how are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm good. Get you all pumped up. Glad to hear you sound like you're in a good mood.
I am in a good mood. The market's rolling. A plan is coming together. What's not to like?
Yeah, that's true. So what's going on? Do you think that what's happening? Is it all this excess money that's coming to the market these days? I know that you and I have talked about the excess liquidity that's going on, the massive amount of bond issuance and credit that's out there. What's kind of, give me the summation.
Well, you know, last year the market fell apart at this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
People kind of forget that in the summer of last year, the market wasn't actually doing that bad for most of 2008. It had actually gotten back to where it was only about 10% down for the year at the
mm-hmm.
end of August.
Mm-hmm.
And so things were kind of on track, and people thought that maybe the economy would get going again. And then Lehman Brothers happened.
Yeah.
Collapsed. Then Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac collapsed. AIG collapsed. And we had the second coming of the Great Depression. And, you know, the markets fell off a cliff, obviously. But when you go back and look at it, we went through it. We obviously all lived through it. We kind of remember it. But if you go back and look at it again, it's hard to believe how much it fell. It truly crashed over a period of two months.
Right.
It didn't crash on any individual day, but it really crashed. And this absolutely freaked out the government and central bankers. They didn't know what to do exactly at first, but then they gathered their forces and they hit the panic button. The amazing thing is, all governments around the world and all central banks around the world hit the panic button together.
Yep.
And I cannot overestimate how important it is that this happened in a coordinated manner. There wasn't like Germany sitting out there saying, oh, it's not my problem. There wasn't Japan out there saying, oh, it's not my problem. They all got together in a room and they said, there's a problem. We need to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They fixed it and they got together and they decided to do what governments can do, print money, lower interest rates.
Right.
And in an absolutely unprecedented way.
Right. And still doing it.
And so what's important to realize is that the downswing last year was unprecedented, but was not unprecedented. There had been, you know, similar declines in the past. But what was unprecedented and what's really messing people up is that the government and central bank response to that decline was truly historic.
Right.
And we're going to feel the excess liquidity wave from what they did last year and the beginning of this year. For years to come. What that really means is that, and I'll say one other thing, there's been a lot of fear this year that the central banks and the government would step back from the stimulus that they have forced into the economy,
mm-hmm.
and that central banks would start to raise interest rates once the economy started to get up off the ground. But last week, and this is so important for people to realize, the G20 Treasury ministers and central banks got together again in London, and they came out of a meeting and they said, we are not taking our foot off the accelerator.
Yeah, which was amazing, which sparked, obviously, the beginnings of a rally this week around the world for the most part, and put a lot of confidence back in the fact that not only are they going to do that, but essentially also said that they're going to, you know, support the banks at least, you know, for the time that they need to get back on their feet.
You cannot have any more, you know, could not have a larger neon sign flashing out of London that said, buy stocks,
mm-hmm.
in the statement that they put out. he had to kind of read between the lines. It wasn't exactly the easiest thing, statement in the world to understand. But what you have to realize is that if they're going to keep interest rates at current levels, which is basically 0.5% or lower in the United States and Europe and Japan, for at least the rest of this year and probably all of next year, then that is going to provide the liquidity for companies and individuals to repair their balance sheets, lower their debt levels, and begin to spend again.
Well, where's the problem? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And there has to be something. I'm not looking for the bad. That's not the point, though. But where is this going to show up in an either inflationary environment? Where is this going to show up in, you know, some higher taxes? I mean, the money has to be made up somehow, right?
Yes, they are creating a bubble. There's no question about it. But it's sort of like, you know, finding somebody who's dying in the desert, needs water and needs food, and as you're applying, you know, as you're giving them water and food, you're worried about them getting fat.
Yeah, I understand. Right.
I mean, you got to get them off the ground first.
Right. Keep the IV until they're walking, and then you can do something.
And then you can worry about them maybe, you know, overdoing it. And that's right. What the governments are saying. Because, you see, Ben Bernanke, the Fed chief, the Federal Reserve chief of the United States, he is a student of the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And we call this event, this economic event we call the Great Depression, was actually only started off actually to be sort of a really bad recession. They didn't call it the Great Depression.
Right, there was no name at the time. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So you had a stock market crash in 1929 that had some ramifications. Governments made some wrong moves. Central banks made some wrong moves. And pretty soon the economy got worse and worse. But in 1933, about 3 years later, a lot of the stimulus that they had put into the market, into the economy, began to take hold. And the stock market, U.S. stock market, was up 375% from 1933 to 1936.
Mm-hmm.
3 year period, it was up almost 400% from the low.
Unbelievable.
Okay?
Right.
And unemployment was 20%. Everyone was complaining that, you know, how could the market go up so much when so many people are out of work? But what had happened was, just like what the government has just recently done, they had forced so much money into the system that it had to go somewhere, and the excess capital went into speculative investments.
Right.
So what happened next? What made it the Great Depression? Well, in 1936-1937, FDR's government, his leaders, his advisors, decided that the economy was back on its feet, even though unemployment was still around 18%, and that they could start to withdraw the liquidity that they had put in. And they began to raise rates. Now, mind you, this is 3 years later. They began to raise rates and killed the stock market and killed the economy.
Okay? Which is kind of like
so Bernanke has sworn, and you can go back and you can read his speeches even before he became a Fed governor, even before, you know, while he was just a professor in Princeton. He has made a life's work of understanding that event. And when it was his turn to make that same decision, he swore he was not going to take his foot off the accelerator.
The question is, will he ever? I mean, he would probably be so scared at this point that he would never really do it, or do it in such a light manner. I mean, because right now the foot is on, not only on the accelerator, but the nitrous oxide is on right now. I mean, 0 to 0.25% of the Fed funds rate is obviously low. I don't think it was ever that low before, way back when even. I mean, this is the historical low. Question is that,
yeah, and by the way, you know, low interest rates are not a panacea, because, you know, Japan has had low interest rates, has had interest rates under 1% for the last 20 years, and their economy has gone nowhere.
Right. So is this what's happened in China, though, recently? Is this what's happening where the Chinese market went down about 20% in August, when the fear was going to be that the government may pull back and the banks may pull back the loans and all that?
See, that's what's so interesting about this whole question about whether the government is going to step back from its role of providing liquidity. See, what happened in China, the Shanghai stock market went down 20% in late August to early September.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was the economy didn't, understand this, this is really important, the economy didn't falter, corporate growth didn't falter. What made that stock market go down were some officials' comments that were interpreted as saying that the central bank was going to withdraw liquidity.
Right. Well, some banks also said commercial bank, construction bank of construction bank did say that they're going to slow down, and there was some actual numbers that came out that says it was a 70% reduction in July in the amount of loans that were put out. But I agree with you.
But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, the point you're making is
it's the economy faltering. Yeah. It's the government's reaction to the economy that spooked people.
Well, and let's say the other side, John. The other side is in March, April, the economy didn't get any better, but the markets did. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it's the same thing. It's the forward look. It's the anticipation of something is what you're saying.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I think that's exactly right.
So I think that, you know, the government's coming out and the central bank's coming out last weekend and saying they are not going to take their foot off the accelerator. They're going to keep it on until the economy improves. I think that's a real positive for investors. Now, that's not to say that bad stuff won't happen.
Right.
Of course, you know, we'll have earnings disappointments and whatnot. But what's important for people to realize is that there's a positive feedback loop. And as companies feel more confident, they're going to look back and say, boy, we fired too many people last November. We need to start hiring some more again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, other people see their friends and neighbors going back to work. They'll stop saving as much, and maybe they'll buy a little bit more for Christmas now that their IRAs are back in better shape than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get sort of this positive feedback loop going. And people will say, wow, there really was a turn in the fundamentals, even though it seemed like there was only a turn in the money supply.
Right.
Now, the last thing I want to point out here, also I think everyone needs to keep in mind, is that back in 2000, September of 2000, there was an event that just seared itself into my mind. Think back to 2000.
Mm-hmm.
We had the NASDAQ topped out in March of 2000, right? Everybody remembers that.
Yeah, it was my birthday.
Oh, nice.
It was that day, yeah.
You have to remember to be aware on your next birthday. But so the market topped out on March 10th, I think it was.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, it was the 10th. My birthday's the 20th, and there was a few things that happened on the 20th that were pretty ugly.
Okay, so the NASDAQ fell over,
mm-hmm.
and then it fell for about a month, fell real hard.
Right.
But then over the summer, the market recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget that by the middle of September 2000,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the tech stocks were back to their old highs.
Right.
The NASDAQ itself wasn't, but a lot of the key stocks were. So Intel was back to 70. Microsoft and a lot of the chip stocks were didn't make their final highs until October.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the important thing: what killed the market in March 2000, and what the technology in the sector has not ever recovered from, truly.
Mm-hmm.
September 22nd, Intel came out with a statement that shocked everybody. What they said was that their revenues in Europe were down more than they expected, and that they were seeing hints that the revenues in other geographies were declining as well. So the next day, the 23rd, Intel stock went down 20%,
mm-hmm.
and it began a long path from 70 all the way down to the 12 that I got to back in March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, flash forward 9 years. What happened last month?
Yeah, Intel said that they're seeing signs that there's increased, particularly from Asia, they said, particularly in Asia, that
right.
Intel came out with that announcement.
Intel came out and said that mm-hmm. They're seeing increased demand. And last night, Texas Instruments said that they're seeing increased demand and that they raised their revenue and earnings estimates. And ASML, which is a big semiconductor equipment manufacturer in the Netherlands, this morning came out and said that they're seeing increased demand for their equipment. So it's important to realize that it's not just a money thing or a liquidity issue. You know, the fundamentals really are improving, even though it's kind of hard to see through the fog.
But let's also say it's not necessarily in every sector. But I agree with you, particularly in technology. And I think the technology rationale is really interesting, and the reasons why that is, due to the higher productivity. And it makes total sense. I think there's still a little bit of time on our, construction. And, I'm still fascinated that the entire casino area seems to be getting upgraded, because that seems a little bit far-fetched to me. But I agree with you that the fundamentals are definitely improving.
The casino, you may recall that the casinos were a great sector during the last recession. I mean, through the 2000-2003 period, during the last
mm-hmm.
decline.
Right.
The last big decline,
mm-hmm.
bear market, casino stocks did really well. And people expected them to do well this time, but there was a they got into some issues where a lot of the casinos became basically a hotel
and real estate holders
Right. And that's where they got killed, not
right.
in their casino holdings.
Right.
So a lot of them have sort of divested themselves of the non-casino parts of their businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're being upgraded.
One of the things that I do hope is that a lot of companies who are relying on China, because a lot of people are relying on China, Caterpillar, I mean, Wynn, Las Vegas Sands, many of the chip companies, I mean, everybody's relying on China. That's the big talk. I think that we all know that still there's a lot of room to go in Europe.
Well, you know, it's not just China, though. Brazil has a lot of demand for equipment. You know,
India.
They've got some tremendous oil finds off the coast that they are trying to develop. You know, if you've ever flown over Brazil, you realize it's a really big country with lots of empty spaces.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
it's a vibrant economy that where people, are feeling better about themselves, you know, about their situation. Their economy has really did not suffer as much as the rest of the world. And so I think that Brazil will surprise people, even though it's already on people's radar.
Well, let me. I know the only
area that I think people will surprise people is Africa,
for oil especially.
Pardon me?
With oil especially,
especially with oil. You know, it's oil fields in Nigeria, Angola, Horn of Africa are actually they're growing quite rapidly, and it's a huge growth area for U.S. and Norwegian and British oil equipment development companies.
Oil
services companies.
Well, let me. I know you only had a couple of minutes, so let me just mention to everybody that first of all, that if you want to follow John Markman, of course you can read him on MSN Money. He writes a wonderful column there, but also you can follow him on Twitter. What is that?
I'm just JD Markman.
JD Markman. And what's great about that, he puts out some really good information. Always interesting. I think I always enjoy that. He's has a few books out, and I think another one coming. I don't know if you could talk about that yet. And just an absolutely wonderful two different ones, newsletters that give you specific information and ideas on exactly what to buy and his ideas, rationale about the market. So I encourage you. We'll put links on the website on the show notes so you can pick that up, so you can check it out, and encourage it because I read it all the time. I think it's very worthwhile. John Markman, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, talk to you soon, buddy. Bye-bye. And that's going to wrap it up from here at the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. We have some really interesting things coming up. We have some traders. I know a lot of you like to talk and listen to the traders, the actual guys that are in the trenches, so to speak. We have some good guys coming up. One guy out of Australia who I think you're really going to enjoy, who he is an expert really in a lot of things, but banking is one of the things that I think that it's going to be interesting to talk about. What's happening within the banking industry. And we have another gentleman who is just a real, he has some great systems that he's going to bring to us. I've talked with him before, and I think you'll really enjoy him as well. And then the other thing I'm going to mention to you is that if you haven't been listening, I encourage you, it's a little bit of kind of a more basic discussion, the Winning Investor podcast that I do for the Quick and Dirty Tips Network. And we're talking about ETFs right now and shorting and how to short, and there's a lot of things coming up. Actually, the shorting episodes will be coming up very shortly. And, you know, you think you'll enjoy that if you have.